Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Nazarita Goldhammer and Kevin Boilo at Epis Radio. It is August 16th, Wednesday. Our normal time in the week to have a show is on Mondays, but our platform was having technical difficulties, so we've decided to have it today. Next week, we'll revert back to our normal Monday, and we continue on. It's very important to us to maintain our commitment of a weekly show, and we will always do so. If for any reason we don't have a show, it means there were technical difficulties or a serious illness or something like that, but we will continue our consistency that we've maintained for well over 10 years now to bring you this show. So we're talking about nature. The title of the program for the rest of the summer and into the fall is The Interrelational Self and Humanity's Intimacy with Nature. So we start talking about nature. What is it? And I'll give you a simple contrast. So if we take nature and we reify it into a thing, like nature is the woods over there, then or the park over there, we make it into a thing, an objective thing, like other things in the world, like the park, nature, then we run the risk of falling prey to capitalism, colonialism, using nature instrumentally, exploiting nature, exploiting the wild, exploiting our resources. So the other way of looking at it is to see nature as an ontological, existential concept, or better yet, as an understanding. And so what that means is nature is just a word that is an alias or a stand-in for the deep rupture of all experience. Or to link with prior work we've done on the radio program, it's a transcendental quality in human experience. It's where all possibilities reside. We can see that it involves that which presences itself, that which we see in existence, trying to make sense of the sensuous experience that we have, adumbrations of things, intuitions of, I'm just calling them things as a placeholder. It's really easy to fall into that way of thinking. But the idea is that nature is everything. It's a full, not only the human life world, but it's the life world of all life on this planet and beyond. And so within within nature, this concept of life, there are relationships between, for lack of a better word, its parts, its aspects, domains, dimensions, some of them can be symbiotic, some of them can be parasitic, some of them can be exploitative. So when I say that, well, I guess another important element is the meaning element. You know, what is the meaning of this transcendental quality to experience? What is the meaning of the wild? What is the meaning of nature? Not necessarily as a concept or a thing. Let's say as a quasi-concept, but not a thing. So it's a word that we use to designate life and the part of us that participates in the world in a bodily way, in an embodied way. And so we have to be really, so we know that it's intersubjective, and we know that it's really easy to get sucked into what we call the natural attitude, where it's the basic flat-footed approach to existence, where you just wake up in the morning and the world is the way it is, and you just accept it blindly, and you go about your day, and you don't question it, you don't seek to interrogate it or be creative with it, or seek possibilities in it. You just accept it. So in other words, the world structuralizes you, and in that mode of consciousness, you're not free, but only because you've chosen it, because you haven't put yourself in a position of thinking about these things, creative, critically creative, not in a negative way, in a positive way, to ruminate and cogitate about meanings and values, prejudices. So all too often in the last few hundred years, we have sought to commodify everything. And that means you have to reify experiences, things, in order to commodify them. It's a way of organizing experience that supports capitalism and exploitation and extraction. So we always want to look at the horizon of our experience. Here's an example of my life. I have a horizon of experience in Southern California. It is a horizon in the sense that I can't change the geography of California or the culture here. It has a reality. And yes, I have a place in it, and I have a relationship to it, and I can interpret it. But it affords certain kinds of possibilities, just like if I were to live in Florida. And I know that these two places are different from my horizon of experience, deeper into mountains and rivers, forests, for example, in California or Montana or some other place, where I'm not so fettered or colonized by the human footprint on the planet. So this is important because we have to constantly strategize in how we're going to deal with our cultural and social rules, protocols, etiquettes, how they really powerfully constrain who we are. I mean, you have to pay your taxes. You have to pay for gas. You have to sign documents at the DMV to get a driver's license. I mean, those are facts. Whether we like it or not, we have to do those things. And the problem is that these bureaucratized pieces of life have multiplied, they become bigger, and this transcendental region of experience where nature is seen as everything and nature is experience becomes lost. Now, Nazarita Goldhammer joins us today. Nazarita, welcome to the show. We're talking about nature like we were last time, and we look forward to hearing your comments.
Well, it's interesting. You know, a lot of people, when they think of nature, I think most people think of getting away, you know, removing ourselves from the day-to-day life that we have created. We've created a certain life that is regimented, that does not allow in the wild, and in ourselves, I think as most humans, they think of wild as something that you experience your wildness when you're young, you know, sowing your oats, so to speak, or having fun, and then you grow up, right? And you leave behind this wildness. And so more and more people, because of this attitude and what we've built into our culture of alienating the wildness, not only in ourselves, but in our communities, our counties where we live, we seek to find it outside of ourselves. And so part of that, is that most people want a community that is regimented. There are lots of restrictions of what you can put on your porch, how you can do your yard, how you can build without a permit from a class of people that want to restrict the look and feel of where you live. And so this buys really into what people are really seeking. So instead, they conform to their community standards in the way that they live, and then they take a vacation to Yellowstone to experience and see the wildness. But they don't want it too wild, because then, of course, they are prone to danger. They don't want any danger connected with the wild. It's like a movie. They want to see the movie, but they don't want to live the movie. I remember I just saw this great video on Earthships. And they were just so beautiful, these houses that are meant to use recycled ingredients in their building materials, plus they are ecologically viable with the environment where they're built. They reuse everything. They are self-sustaining. And I saw someone who had visited three of them, and the first one was kind of modernized, and the second one was the one that is in New Mexico that is just an exquisite Earthship. It is meant to be self-sufficient. It has everything that you need to live. It has a rainwater system and a gray water system that recycles water, that waters plants in the middle of a desert, of which most people would die immediately if they were left there for a week. So this is kind of a marvelous kind of way of building, and yet the experience was she saw a mouse. And the mouse was just a little too wild for her taste. Like, she wanted all the wildness, all the nature experience, but didn't want to actually have any of the wild in the house. And I thought this was really a great metaphor for what we're fighting against in who we are as a being, as a human species being. Like, we have to look at what is the wild in us. Why are we always seeking the wild? Because we have so constricted that part of ourselves. It could be the wild eros that is the feeling that uses more than a couple of the senses that we think are available to us when we have a multitudinous amount of senses that are really available to us, but we don't use. We have amazing ability to see things, but we don't use that ability. And so slowly we begin to box ourselves in, and we don't see clearly anymore. We don't hear things that we should hear in nature. And consequently, that's what we expect in our nature experience when we go outside to get into nature. So I guess what I'm saying is that these are connected. When our experience of wanting the wild nature and our experience of closing off the wild nature in ourselves, and then thinking that we have to go outside somewhere to get it, but we don't really want what it's presenting. I think that's the big paradox that everybody that goes on these vacations, they experience. They want to see a bear, but they want to pet the bear. But they don't want the bear to growl or to hurt them. And this is the paradox that we live as beings in this culture of our wildness is separate from who we think we should be. we think we should be these automatons that are highly regimented on a clock and in ourselves, that this is appropriate only in this circumstance, you can only do this in this circumstance. You're unfree to express yourself ever. There's all these restrictions, and we're putting those restrictions back on nature, even though at the meantime we're seeking out the wild in nature, we're stymied by that confrontation of the wildness in nature. Does that make any sense?
It is. What everything that you say brings up this overriding question for me, and that is that, we talked about it even this morning, how we make meaning. You know, where does meaning come from? What's the source of meaning? And we're just talking about this American Prairie organization in the state of Montana. This is a perfect example. So American Prairie ostensibly is a conservation project to protect 3.2 million acres of prairie land in Montana, which sounds like a really wonderful thing. I would want to get more information. I'm curious to get more information about how American Prairie is going to be attempted to be colonized by capitalism, commodified. Colonized in the way that it's determined to be a thing or a group of things for human meaning. You see what I'm getting at? It's about that the meaning, I'm worried that the meaning continues to come from the human and only the human, even in this prairie conservation project. So just hearing bits and pieces from a couple of videos about it, when people describe it, people who work for it, they describe it as a way to maintain a culture from the Old West. And already the red flags came up because it's about serving humans, human pleasure in some way, human interest. And so the source of meaning in that way of thinking is that it comes solely from the human. As opposed to the question, where else can meaning come from? Because we are constantly shaped. This is what people don't want to accept. We are constantly shaped by the world. We're constantly shaped by the planet, by materiality and physicality. We're shaped by geography. We're shaped by everything, all experience and all pieces of being. They impinge on us all the time. That's, we live within being. And so I think it's an obvious question to ask whether some meaning comes from outside the human experience. I mean, you can get down into the dirt and say, no, meaning is something that can only come from humans. The problem with that position is that it lands you into an anthropocentrism, a speciesism, right? If I say by fiat, only, the word meaning, we're the only meaning makers, then I have a political, scientific position, economic position that says all meaning comes from the human, and then that value system determines everything I do with American Prairie. On the other hand, if I say, well, that's just false because I'm constantly shaped by the external world. I'm shaped by others. I have an interrelational being. And I'm constantly shaped by what is outside of me, by what is other than me. So if I'm constantly shaped, then by what's outside of me, isn't it fair, Nazarita, to say that some meaning, therefore, must also reside in what is external to me? Here's a super simple example. I can sit down and have a conversation with somebody, and if I have a conversation and say, well, I'm the only meaning maker in the conversation isn't going to go anywhere. And we call that narcissism. But if I start admitting that meaning comes from sentient beings outside of myself and further, then I have to allow that they make meaning in a way that's the same as me or similar to me. And if I do that, then I start constructing an ontology that says, look, humans are not at the center. We're just one meaning maker. And then you start looking at that and you analyze the concrete example of American Prairie in Montana. And you could ask questions like, what do the grasslands want? What do the animals there want? What is their way of life, their culture? What is important to them? What is their intention and aim and meaning and transmission of value? What do you think about that, Nazarita?
I think that's really interesting because this same questioning that you're using really applies to almost everything, like dreams. You can ask the symbol, what does it want? What is its meaning? Not just how you interpret the symbol or the dream, but what is the dream meaning for you? Like what is the dream trying to tell you? Like each aspect of everything in the dream holds a key to its own experience and its own being. Like if you were that part of the dream, what are you trying to say? And so this also holds true in houses. Like if you are the house, if you are your interior, what are these things trying to tell you? And yes, you might have acquired them, but they're trying to give something that holds a different meaning. They're trying to tell you something. And so I do think that this is true in terms of the external world that we live in nature. Like what do the grasslands want? What are they doing? And most humans think that they have to control nature. They think that nature for some reason would be, I don't know what the ultimate is, but out of control, out of control. Nature will be out of control. Other animals will be out of control. And yet, in reality, humans are the only species that when times become desperate, they don't have less children. They have more children. And I've always found this really interesting that other species in times of famine, in times of hardship, they limit how many children they have because they know that they can only do so much for what they have. And so they limit them. Sometimes they don't have any children at all. And yet humans are the exact opposite. The poorer you are, the more children you have. The more hardship you have, the more children you have. The more food becomes scarce, the more children you have. And it's like this goes counter to the reality of nature, to conserve, to look, to see, to experience, to be part of nature. We set ourselves away from nature in so many ways. And I've read some on American Prairie, and I know people think of it as an interim step. You don't have ranchers that are ruining the land with raising cattle. As much as people like to think of the American West as full of ranches and beef eating and slaughtering cows and other animals for the pleasure of the multitude, really a step away from that is preserving land. But what is it preserved for? Is it preserved for hunters, for people to charge money for people to camp? For, you know, people to use the land. And I think it's really interesting because we're so out of tune with nature that we are always shocked when we live in a place that is prone to natural nature disasters, that we're always shocked that it happens. This really tells me the ultimate disconnect that we have with the land. Like if we're building on in an earthquake zone, we're going to have earthquakes. God isn't going to stop an earthquake. And so I know many people pray to not have that. And yet that is a foolish way of thinking, because, you know, that means that you're looking at nature as a thing to be controlled again by somebody else. You know, I've always liked a quote by, there's a resource from American Indians, and I've always liked it, and I always think of this because we're so caught in this consumer culture, this culture that we live in all over the world, that says, and this is what it says, no one owns the water, no one owns the land, no one owns the oceans, no one owns the sand. These are given to us by our mother, the planet, provides for free by the hands of the greedy. Does the earth require a fee? And I'm always struck by that, because I think how we've colonized places when other people were living there, and then written history books that say that we've discovered something. We've discovered some area that other people have lived on for hundreds and thousands of years, but suddenly somebody has discovered it, and now it becomes for sale. And I think that's what we're doing with nature. We're trying to commodify nature to fit our repressed eros, our repressed wildness. We are commodifying things so that we might feel a little more in tune with nature, but in reality, it is counterintuitive. It goes against what we're really trying to achieve. And that is in relationships. You brought that up. I think that that's very, very interesting. If one person thinks that the other person shouldn't have a voice or is never right, then it is a warped sense of being. It is saying that the other one doesn't have value. Just like nature, if we control nature, that means that nature doesn't have a value by itself. It means that it only has a value if we manipulate it, control it, manipulate it, kill part of it so that it fits our small box that we want to put it in.
Yeah, so I mean, just the story that we're telling here in this discussion is troubling. It's deeply troubling. We continue to cut up the wild nature. We cut up. It's interesting. We take raw experience that has so much potentiality for freedom, and we oppress it. In other words, we deal with it in a certain way. So it just occurs to me that we could leave some wildlands alone. That's one option, just to leave them completely alone. Another option is to find peaceful coexistence with the land. And then the other option is to do what we're doing now, where we're exploiting and extracting. So yeah, I'd like to have a discussion about this. Do we cordon off certain areas in the planet and say these are off limits to humans? Do we do that? And just see what happens. In other words, be respectful of the natural ecosystem processes, or do we have a gentle hand in facilitating ecosystem management? And what are your thoughts on that? How involved do we get, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Well, I think that we all have the responsibility to actually get involved, those who see what's going on. We have that responsibility. We can't sit back. Otherwise, we are an equal participant in killing nature. If we do nothing, then we are a silent participant, but we are a participant. And so we have to do things that change. And it's hard for me to imagine that the ultimate would be, of course, to have places where humans are not able to censor nature. They're not able to control nature. And yet, it's hard for me to think that that will actually happen, knowing the way that humans are. I mean, it always goes back to, I always think of this way of thinking. You know, if humans were really good, we wouldn't have locks on our doors. We wouldn't have fences around anything, because humans are very destructive. They are a destructive species. And so we're always on the lookout, knowing that there will be destruction wherever humans are. And so could they leave land alone? I really doubt it. I don't think that. I mean, look at what's going on in Alaska. Whenever you have states or counties that ignore the will of the people who want to have more nature, and you enact laws to say that you're ignoring what the majority of people say they want, and you're enacting laws for your own small, narrow-minded benefit, which is happening actually in Montana. They're passing laws without, when the population has voted against something, they are already passing it, regardless of what was voted on. Now that tells me that something is going on in the world, that there's this huge conflict that we're encountering, that we're butting up against a mindset of a primitive thinking person that doesn't care about nature, about what other people think. They're going to railroad everybody, and if they're in a position of power, they're going to do what they want, which is kind of what we've done with big oil companies, gas companies, mining companies. We have let them, through our own participation, silent participation, allow them to destroy the earth. They've now linked fracking to earthquakes, which everybody knows, because everywhere they frack, they have earthquakes. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to say fracking is causing earthquakes. But still, people are not able to stop fracking. And so that's what I mean by silent, our responsibility. We have to tackle our silent participation. And we have to get down to the very bottom of what we are willing to actually do. And that's the question everybody should be asking. What are we willing to do? It isn't what is going on and how horrendous, and we're sitting back still utilizing the main problems. We're still interacting and using the resources that are destroying the earth. We have to say, what are we willing to change? How are we willing to change? Can we change? And I think that means standing up for that which we see is happening to the world, and we have to change that. So everybody has that responsibility. I think that's my main point, is that there isn't one person that doesn't have that responsibility, but it's how much are you willing to change? Are you willing to be a silent participant in this destruction of the earth? Or are you willing to actually change and stand up for stopping that which is hurting the earth? And that means personal change as well.
Yeah, well, so how do we stand up? How do we go from insight to the moral? That's my big concern. How do we do that? And I don't mean to just push this back on you, but how do we get from this place where people are desperate or complacent or stingy to a place of the fully formed moral agent who can take responsibility and participate? How do we get to that point? That's my big question here. I don't know. How do we get there? How do we develop that self system that becomes moral?
Don't you think
I think we used to have it and have it, but it's been suppressed. I think it's been pushed down.
I think that you're right. So it isn't something, that even though it isn't something I think that we need to evolve, even though I do believe that on an evolutionary curve, we really have to change the way that we think, and we are in an evolution for our species. But other than that, I think that people intrinsically know, like they know when something is wrong. They may not want to do anything about it, but in terms of, I think that I've just watched some things on building earthships and straw bale and many different kinds of alternative housing that are earth friendly, that actually protect and enhance the ecosystem. And yet there are, we have in place building permits, people who only, builders, construction companies that only build one way. So just think if we could change that. Most dome buildings or earth straw bale or rammed earth or adobe, not adobe, but most of those buildings require permits, and there's a lot of places that can't permit because they don't know anything about them, and they won't allow a permit unless it's outside where they don't require permits. So already there's one instance in just our building codes how we can change that. Another is, you know, do we own the water? We have to change certain things. We have to stand up. Like, what is the water that falls from the sky? What is rain? How do we capture that? You know, how do we use the sun's rays? How do we grow our own food? And yet I know there are so many communities that won't let you do that. Now, that is going totally against what we should be doing. People who are against electric cars or against another means of transportation that doesn't use oil and gas, even in our face products, we can stand up and say, why are we using petroleum in facial products? It just seems so, it seems outrageous when we really think about it. You and I have talked about how products sold in America are very different from the manufacturers selling them in Europe, that they actually take out some of the chemicals that they sell to Americans and they make it more pure to sell to Europeans because Europeans have certain laws that say you can't use those. But why are we caught in the United States in this miasma of thinking that we cannot stand up for that which is healthier, which supports the ecosystem, which isn't destructive? And I think we can do it. I don't think that that's something we can't do. I think that we're unwilling to do it for many psychological reasons that you point out so accurately, fear of being ostracized, fear of someone saying bad things about you, fear of your neighbors disliking you. And yet it just takes a minor change and people begin to say, this is worthwhile. And I think that's what people don't realize. The one person who stands up might be reviled in the beginning, but eventually everybody will mimic that person. That's really what it takes. Active participation in the choices that you know are right. One is obviously plant-based diet. If you know cows are killing the planet, why would you want to have more? And if you ask somebody, they would say, of course we don't want to have more. But if you continue to be a passive participant by eating meat, then you're encouraging the destruction of the earth and the soil and the grasslands and everything else that goes with a healthy ecosystem.
Right. You know, something I've learned through my life and more as I've gotten older is that what one person does really does make a difference. And there were times in my life where I wasn't so sure about that. Seriously, uncertain, unclear about it, troubled by it, concerned that one person could not have any effect and especially if they're somebody who's not, you know, a billionaire or a famous politician. So the question is, how can the average random citizen of the world participate in a much better world, a much better biosphere, in all the ways that we've been discussing? And I've come to the conclusion that, excuse me, each person has a value. It's like, it's really true to those people on the internet and various social media, especially the vegans who say, well, I've planted a seed. By bringing up something, we plant a seed. If you have a good thought, say it. If we have a good thought, say it. Because it plants a seed. And sometimes people need to hear the same thing many times for many years. That's okay. We need to be patient. We can't, I mean, some people we tell something important to and they'll change on a dime in a day. Other people will take 30 years. That's okay. So Nazarene, I think part of it is psychological, spiritual, where a person can say in their quiet time, their meditative moments, at night or in the morning, I do matter. I love myself. I am part of life. I am here. I have autonomy. I am empowered to say who I am. It's about being free. And so there's a huge link, I think, between being free and being moral. And you can't control the world. But what you can do within your own freedom, you can think about things, feel things, you can grow, and then you can say what your truth is and plant that idea. What do you think about that, Nazarita?
I think that's really true. I remember a time that I was in a group and everybody was, there was like 100 people, and everybody was told that they should stand up for to support this thing that I disagreed with. I had come to the decision that I didn't agree with it. And 100 people, and we're all told to stand up to show our support. Every single 99 people stood up except for me. And I remember realizing that, wow, this is a very lonely position to be ostracized, to be looked at with not only concern but hatred, that you were going against what the majority thinks. And yet, I can tell you it was mind-shattering to me to realize I was in that position and that I was the only one. And but I can tell you that from that seed, other people, and I left that group, and I can tell you that other people left that group too, because I believe it was a seed. It's like saying, I am no longer going to stand up for that which is not right. I'm not going to be a passive person that stands up, even though I disagree, and I'm not going to continue doing what I disagree with. I'm not going to do it. And I've never regretted that. And some of my very, some of my friends are still my friends that left. And I believe that was like a seed. That was, you have to stand up for what you believe. Or in this case, you have to sit down for what you believe. Or in some cases, you have to bend a knee for what you believe in. You have to.
Well, look, we're just about out of time. That's we have 14 seconds left. I want to thank everybody who comes to the Epis Radio and listens. Thanks to Nazarita. Thanks to myself. We will be back at our regular time this coming Monday, 9 o'clock in the morning PST. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.